Well, as it's approaching the hour of 7 and we know your time is valuable, we'd like to start on time. Good evening and welcome to the 5th presentation in this, our 14th season of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster taking pictures at the back, Haiwan Wan, and our research instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Ryan Dowell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadon Melky. Our speaker tonight is a native of Portland, Maine, and moved to Lexington, Kentucky when his father was transferred there by IBM. His interest in history stems from a visit to West Point when he was only 4. An Army officer who taught there lived across the street. And at age 8, the centennial of the Civil War started, which he followed closely, reading the American Heritage Illustrated, and even collected Civil War bubblegum cards. At scout camp, he met the first Medal of Honor recipient from the Vietnam War, whose picture had been on the front cover of the Saturday Evening Post. These experiences encouraged him to study history at Notre Dame University, where he wrote about T.E. Lawrence of Lawrence of Arabia fame for his senior thesis. He returned to Lexington and the University of Kentucky, where he earned an M.A. and Ph.D. in history with a special interest in European diplomatic history post-1848. His research on the Hague Peace Conferences and disarmament has appeared in the Royal United Services Institute Journal. His research on the early history of the Marine Corps has appeared in the Marine Corps Gazette and the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society. And he used a grant from the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation to do research on Major General Logan Thieland, a native of Hopkinsville, Kentucky, who played a major role in the development of the modern Marine Corps. This led to his first book, Kentucky Marine, Major General Logan Thieland and the Making of the Modern U.S. Marine Corps, which was published by the University Press of Kentucky in 2014, and which won the 2015 Colonel Joseph Alexander Award for Biography. In his newest book, Kentucky and the Great War, World War I on the Home Front, published last October, also by the University Press of Kentucky, he provides the first comprehensive analysis of the impact of the Great War on bluegrass society, politics, the economy, and culture. He's presently working on a new monograph on the Marine Corps in World War I. He retired as the director of the Office of International Affairs at the University of Kentucky and presently lives with his wife in Scott County on a small lake where he enjoys sailing and sculling. Please give a warm welcome to David Betty. David?
Thank you, Brian, for setting this up. I really appreciate it. I want to thank Joe Corcoran, who actually had to go home and get a few wings sleep before he does his early morning radio program, for writing a very nice review of my book in the Bowling Green paper on Sunday. I want to thank Barnes & Noble for providing this nice venue. And I want to thank all of you for coming out here this evening to listen to me talk. I will be talking this evening about World War I, the Great War, still called the Great War mainly in England, but not so much here. Oops. And I'll put this table of contents up to sort of guide you and me on what is involved with Kentucky during World War I. Not to be confused with the greatest generation of World War II, which some of my friends did. As I was finishing the book, Kentucky Marine, I started looking around for other projects. I've been interested in World War I for a long time. The Kentucky Marine I wrote about was a hero, Marine Corps hero during World War I, so it's natural that I just follow on. And I picked up a couple of books about a different aspect of the war, and that was the domestic aspect. And the first one was, it was still a classic, it's David Kennedy's Over Here. And I followed that up with a book by Christopher Capozzola called Uncle Sam Wants You. And I started thinking about, well, what was the situation of Kentucky during World War One? How did Kentuckians respond? And I found out that there was a Kentucky Council of Defense, and they created a position of a state war historian late in 18, and he worked with the county historians, a designated historian in each county in Kentucky, all 120 of them, and to create county histories of the war. And the county histories were primarily records of the soldiers from the county who went off to war, great for genealogists, but they also included stuff about, you know, Liberty Loan campaigns and so on and so forth. So I started looking for these things. Each county had one, you know, volume, and they were all deposited in the county clerk's office initially. So I started going to county clerk's offices and trying to find these, and I was successful in some. And some had migrated to libraries. The history for Warren County is actually in special collections. Some have migrated to historical societies. And so I managed to visit about half of Kentucky's counties and found several of these. And then I supplemented this with research trips to Washington and Atlanta, the National Archives branch in Atlanta. And so I was able to come up with a fairly good, I think, maybe not comprehensive, I shouldn't use that word, but a good overview of how Kentucky responded to World War One. And two major themes sort of came out. One was the permeation of government down to the very smallest communities. I'm talking about coal camps in eastern Kentucky during this period. And also, there was a great increase in civic responsibility and participation in the war. So, I wrote the book, and before we get too far in, let me set this clock for about 40 minutes so I can not go over too much, and then you all can ask some questions. Anyway, let's start with Kentucky in 1914. It's a highly agricultural state, what state historian Jim Clotter calls a portrait and paradox. It was had a declining lumber industry, but the coal industry was starting to boom. There were well-known literary figures in Kentucky, people like Irvin Cobb and James Lane Allen and so forth, and yet there was a high illiteracy rate in the state. People were tied to their small communities, particularly their counties, and I deliberately use counties throughout the book as a frame of reference for these. Poor communications throughout the state, and the state was marred by political infighting. I mean, after all, we, you know, had a governor assassinated, right, in 1900. And the infighting wasn't just between the Democrats and the Republicans. It was within the parties themselves. Some key issues that faced the state were women's suffrage and, of course, prohibition, which was coming in World War One was going to make those folks very happy, actually, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So, okay, August 1914, well, let's back up. June 28th of 1914, Archduke Franz Ferdinand is killed and is assassinated in Sarajevo. It was reported a little bit in Kentucky papers, particularly the Kentucky Post, you know, Louisville Courier Journal, Lexington Herald, and the Leader. But for the most part, this sort of bypassed many of the small county newspapers. If anyone expected a war to break out, and even the Europeans didn't, I mean, they went, as Christopher Clark, British historian, called it, they went sleepwalking into this thing. If anybody really anticipated a war in the United States, it was going to be with Mexico. I mean, we invaded Mexico in April of 1914. A few people paid attention to the war, particularly two newspaper editors who have become quite focused on it. One was, of course, Henry Watterson of the Louisville Courier Journal. The other was the Shea Breckinridge of the Lexington Herald. Some Kentuckians were in Europe when the war broke out in August, late July and in early August of 1914. The Bishop of Covington was caught visiting his relatives in Belgium, couple of young women sponsored on a trip, European trip by Election Herald, got caught over there and finally made it back the end of August or September. Some Kentuckians actually went toward the sound of the guns. Probably one of the most famous ones was a Western Kentuckian by the name of Irvin Cobb. He was a journalist from Paducah. He'd gone on to New York, and once the war broke out, he jumped on a ship and went to, over to Belgium and sent back articles that were published in the Saturday Evening Post, which was a widely read magazine at the time. Cobb then used these articles to create a book and returned to Europe after America entered the war in 1917. Another Kentuckian that went over there was a fellow named Alexander McClintock, a young man from Fayette County in Lexington, who joined the Canadian Army and was posted abroad and went through some horrific battles in 1915 and 16. He was grievously wounded, was sent to England to recuperate. He was there in a hospital in London when King George came by and actually gave him Britain's second highest award for valor. He then came back to the United States to recuperate some more and wrote a book about his experience in the Great War. So, of course, eventually the United States did enter the war, April 6, 1917. Kentucky's congressional delegation pretty much supported Wilson's decision to go to war. And this is in sharp contrast with some of the folks from the South. There were particularly a couple of guys in the South, Tom Watson from Georgia and James Vardaman from Mississippi, who were totally opposed to the idea of the war. It was considered by many, particularly in the South, the rural South, as a Northeasterners' war. One that was brought on by bankers and munitions manufacturers. There is a great book about the opposition to the war in the South by a woman named Jeanette Keefe. It's called Rich Man's War, Poor Man's Fight, and I recommend it to everyone. But anyway, in Kentucky, delegation supported the war, and there were celebrations throughout Kentucky when the U.S. declared war. Immediately, there were some signs of repression. You know, Kentucky has had a strong German heritage population. You especially see this all along the Ohio River from Covington down to Paducah. There was some repression. Some German institutions like banks started changing their name from the German American Bank and so forth. Most of the repression that I found took place in Northern Kentucky, quite frankly. There was a particular district attorney who led what was basically a vigilante group, the Citizens Patriotic League, and they sought out German sympathizers and whipped them and made them contribute to the Red Cross and so forth. They were responsible for probably the most widely known case of repression in Kentucky, one that was reported in New York Times. They caught a reverend from Cincinnati coming over to Covington to give a talk, and they took him out and into the countryside and whipped him, and didn't tar and feather him. They just put oil over him and feathered him. So, and this made the American Civil Liberties Board at the time news and so forth, and again made the Times. There was a when the legislature came in to sit in January of 1918, they passed an anti-German language bill, which Governor A.O. Stanley actually vetoed. He suggested that you were not fighting German language and culture, but instead we were fighting this pernicious German autocracy, this government, the so-called Huns, okay? So, in Louisville, there was some, but much less of this. I attribute this to the fact that the Germans in Louisville were much more assimilated. After all, there was a German mayor, Buschmeyer. Anyway, so everyone was expected to participate in the war effort. Okay, if you didn't participate in supporting the war, What were you called? Slacker. Okay. You did not want to be known as a slacker. There was an effigy of a Liberty Loan slacker hanging from a lamppost in front of the courthouse in Lexington for 2 weeks. Okay? I understand sometimes slacker these days, somebody young kind of see that as a badge of honor, but you didn't want to be a slacker, and people would know it. In Scott County, where I live, in the newspaper would put the names of the people who contributed to the $1,000 fund for the Red Cross. They put these names in the paper. Well, if you were pretty well off and your name didn't appear in the paper, what did people think you were? You were a slacker, okay? So there were lots of ways that people could participate. One of the best, probably the organization that benefited the most in Kentucky from the war was the American Red Cross. Before the United States entered the war, there were about, I think, less than a half a dozen chapters of the Red Cross. Nobody knew what the Red Cross was. By the time they had the conference, Red Cross conference in Lexington in the fall of 17, there were Red Cross chapters in 115, I think, out of the 120 counties. In Scott County, again, I'm using my own place. Women and young girls would meet in a space above the doctor's office, and we'd create comfort kits for soldiers and also bandages for the hospital unit that was being recruited out of Good Sam Hospital in Lexington. So that was a great opportunity for people to participate. Down in Fulton County, it was reported that businessman J.O. West conducted weekly auctions supporting the Red Cross. He auctioned farm products, livestock, etc., but went further. He was reported as auctioning a bunch of green onions contributed by a poor widow, the baseball park. He auctioned off the Mississippi River, a flock of geese flying overhead, and an old gentleman's whiskers. And I think he raised about $1,500 for this, and that was a pretty significant amount down in Fulton County in 1917. Another way that some people could participate was joining the so-called four-minute men. These are businessmen who would go into theaters and talk about topics that were given to them by George Creel's Committee of Public Information in Washington. Why 4 minutes? Because that was the time necessary to change reels on a film. Okay. So they go in and they give their short speech, and they were trained to really stick to it. And this was brilliant. Because, this was in a state, actually in a country, but in a state that had a high illiteracy rate. So you can crank out all the paper you want and give it to people. some of them are not going to be able to read it. On the other hand, some prominent businessman stands up in front of you in the theater, and the theaters were the place to be. I mean, you find theaters in small coke camps in eastern Kentucky. Somebody gets up and tells you buy Liberty Bonds, and you might be inclined to do so. So, four-minute men, you could participate and really were expected to participate by buying savings bonds. Okay. There were five bond campaigns, four during the war and one after the Victory Loan campaign. Kentucky surpassed goals, I think, in every one of these. There was also a war savings stamps program, which enabled you to buy savings stamps at in denominations as 25 cents, so that kids could buy these things, okay? So you could raise your victory garden, or not a victory garden, they weren't called that then, but your garden, and sell us proceeds to buy victory stamps. Well, before the war broke out, President Wilson had created something called the Committee on National Defense, and his task was to look at the economic preparation for a possible war. There's a great debate in the United States before the war about preparedness. Our military was very weak, only about 100,000 men in the military. And so, within this great debate, there was the National Council of Defense. Well, when the U.S. entered the war, each state formed a Council of Defense. We had the Kentucky Council of Defense. It was headed first by a Louisville lawyer and then second by a Louisville lawyer, but it included people like Richard Stahl, who was a well-known Lexington lawyer. He had been a football star. He was vice chairman of the UK Board of Trustees, which meant he really was the chairman because the governor was the, you know, quote, chairman. And for whom they named a football field for him, the one prior to the one that they're playing in now. Richard Stahl, they're obviously Brown from, you know, the Brown Foreman, the liquor folks. William Cochran, who was a lawyer up in Maysville. Point being that they were actually, it was pretty much a bipartisan committee, unbelievably. Stahl was a prominent Republican. Cochran was a strong Democrat. Then there was one other fella that you all would be more familiar with who was on the Kentucky Council of Defense, and that was one H.H. Cherry, who was, of course, the president of what was then Western Normal. He pretty much kept this group going through the fall of 1917. The council didn't have any funding yet. The legislature wasn't going to meet until January. But Cherry jumped in there, and he was head of the publicity committee. He traveled all over the state giving talks about why, you know, you should support the war. He brought in speakers. He brought in William Howard Taft to a Chautauqua conference here. He had a teachers' conference. He was over in Louisa, which is way on the far eastern border below Ashland. He went to West Liberty and deep in the mountains of Kentucky, eastern Kentucky. He really worked very, very hard on this, almost ruined his health, and toward the fall of 1918, basically had to give this up so he could focus on activities at Western Kentucky University, like bringing in a student army training corps. Anyway, the Council of Defense, its job was to sort of promote support of the war, promote liberty bonds. They established county councils of defense, which then had these historians who wrote, you know, the county history. The counties were then broken down into smaller segments based on school districts. So what you see is you know, we're coming down from Washington into Frankfort to the Kentucky Council of Defense, into the county councils, and then down into the school districts, and so this is, indicates a really strong movement of government into the lives, basically the daily lives of Kentuckians. Boyle County, Danville, had over 300 people just involved on committees. The accomplishments included conferences, passing along guidance to, they wrote, they had written a legal guide for the families of the soldiers from Kentucky. They supported programs like Patriotic Week and so on and so forth. Okay, one of the big issues that came up immediately, of course, is how are we going to fight this war with an army of 100,000 men? Okay, that wasn't obviously going to do the trick. So Wilson and his advisors came up with this idea of having a so-called draft, or what they call the selective service system, that would be run by the states themselves. There was a little bit more congressional resistance against this. Some guys thought that this should be a volunteer effort, but that wasn't going to be the case. There was going to be a selective service system. There was some opposition to not only the draft and the war in general, but again, it did not reach the proportions that it did in some of the southern states. I think federal troops were called in to four southern states to quell disturbances, groups of deserters, draft dodgers that gathered in bands. But you didn't really find that in Kentucky. There was some opposition. The most famous case was a Baptist preacher named Boyce Taylor, who had the First Baptist Church down in Murray. And he was totally against the war. I mean, he just thought this was terrible, and he wrote about this in a weekly newsletter, about an 8-page newsletter that he had every week. He was condemned by other Baptists. The First Baptist Church in Richmond condemned him. People were up in arms. He was investigated by the Kentucky Council of Defense and by federal authorities from the Bureau of Investigation. But Boyce Taylor was a bit lucky because he managed to make his comments before they passed the Espionage Act of 1917. About a week before, so he was never pinned down. He ameliorated his opposition a little bit, but I mean he was against the YMCA helping out at Camp Taylor and so on and so forth. There were some Holiness Church preachers down in eastern Kentucky who opposed the war on religious grounds, and they weren't so lucky. Several of them were actually caught and tried and convicted and spent some time down in a federal penitentiary down in Atlanta. There were other cases. Another famous case that was written up in the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society, there were three German heritage guys talking in a barbershop in Covington about the war, and they, unbeknownst to them, their comments were being recorded by a dictograph that was hidden in a grandfather clock. Make a long story short, the jury for these three guys separately each took about 25 minutes to convict them of, they were actually, I think, convicted of sedition. I think they were unlucky. They did their stuff after the Sedition Act of 1918. Anyway, they spent time in about a year each in a federal penitentiary up in West Virginia. But on the whole, Kentuckians pretty much accepted the war and accepted the draft. The head of the draft was a guy named Henry Rhodes down in Frankfort. Again, the draft, Wilson and his advisors are smart because they put the draft in the hands of local authorities. Usually the draft board was initially consisted of the sheriff, and then a physician, and then another person, usually a businessman, in each of the counties. There were some problems with the draft, but not a whole lot. On whole, the Kentucky draft system ran fairly well. There were some problems in eastern Kentucky, but they were primarily problems of communication. You know, some guys weren't getting their draft notices. They weren't getting their notice to report some of them didn't even know they had to register. And if they registered, they were simply called delinquents. But if they registered and then didn't go when called, they were actually termed as deserters. You know, it wasn't that, you had to be in the Army and then leave. It was if you didn't show up, you were a deserter. And there was a bounty of $50 for each deserter that was caught. And so some sheriffs, particularly, again, in Eastern County, Eastern Kentucky, made a bit of money this way. But, the real problem was probably communications. A lot of these guys, if they could read, probably never got the notices. Anyway, some resistance, but nothing like in the southern states. Well, let's see here. If you were drafted in Kentucky, for the most part, you were going to end up in a place called Camp Taylor, just south of Louisville. When the war broke out, the Army recognized that they had to have, some massive training camps. And so there were 16 of them built. There was great competition between Louisville and Lexington as to who would get this camp. The editor of the Lexington Herald, DeShay Breckinridge, one of the famous, Breckinridges of Kentucky, he thought really Lexington should have the camp. After all, it was a central location, and it served as a staging area for Kentucky State Guards who went off to war in the Spanish-American War. On the other hand, Louisville thought they should have it, and they recognized, both of them really recognized the enormous economic benefits of having such a camp. What Breckinridge didn't seem to understand was that the Louisville's congressman, a guy by the name of Swagger Shirley, sat on the Appropriations Committee and was on the subcommittee for fortifications. So, gee, no surprise, that Louisville got this camp. Breckinridge was beside himself. He said they're building this camp on a swamp in southern Louisville. It's going to be terrible. But, make a long story short, Louisville got it and did a pretty fantastic job of throwing together this huge camp, over 2,000 buildings within 2-3 months. They've been running telephone, water lines, rail lines into the area. It was a boon. At one point, Camp Zachary Taylor had over 60,000 men training there. Initially, they trained infantry troops from Kentucky, Illinois, and Indiana to go over. And then after that initial training, it became really an artillery training camp. Field Artillery Centralized Officers Training School, FACOTS, was created there. There were other schools. The School for Chaplains, Army Chaplains, was moved out of Maryland to Camp Taylor. This picture down here, which is a snippet from a large panoramic picture, is actually the chaplain school in line for mess, for food. Because Camp Taylor became an artillery training post, there was a need to have an artillery firing range. There was a little one down on the river at West Point, but that really was inadequate, so they went looking farther south from Louisville and created a new camp for artillery training, a place called Camp Knox, okay, which of course was a huge boon to that area, an economic boon to that area, and you know, it still is. So the impact of Camp Taylor on particularly Louisville, but also on Kentucky, was tremendous. It really put Louisville on the map. Even if you didn't train there, when you came back from the war, a lot of people were demobilized there at Camp Taylor. And, of course, famous people went through there, and some famous non-people went through there. The Great Gatsby trained at Camp Taylor. Okay? So, poor Breckinridge, he was just clueless on this. There were lots of institutions set up at the camp to support the soldiers. There was an effort made to keep them occupied in healthy pursuits like checkers and chess and baseball and that sort of thing, to keep them from wandering off into let's say less healthy pursuits in the city of Louisville. Okay, and you can figure that out. This is actually a national problem. YMCA had all kinds of huts there at the camp, the Knights of Columbus, the American Library Association, and so on and so forth. There was an illiteracy campaign, a campaign against illiteracy that was carried on at the camp. A great many of the soldiers simply couldn't read or write, and so there was a national expert from Morehead, Cora Wilson Stewart, who led an effort to train them in reading, and she produced a reader for them and so on. There were other ways in which Kentuckians were expected to participate, and that was in regards to food and fuel. Soon after the U.S. got into the war, Wilson appointed a federal food administrator, a guy by the name of Herbert Hoover, who'd done a pretty good job with relief in Belgium. In Kentucky, there was a Louisville lawyer named Fred Sackett, who was the Kentucky food administrator. There were two aspects of dealing with food. One was to produce more food, and the other was to conserve more food, okay? And so, there was an effort to try to boost wheat and corn production in Kentucky. Initially, there was an attempt to switch from tobacco production to wheat and corn, but then it was just figured out, probably by a lobbyist, that tobacco might be good for soldiers. And in fact, Pershing supported smokes for soldiers. The Louisville Courier-Journal had a fundraiser for buying cigarettes for soldiers. So the tobacco market in Kentucky actually expanded greatly during the war. The other aspect was the conservation of food. Everyone can do that. Women were expected to take the lead in this. They could they signed pledges to conserve food, and you put the little card in your window so everybody would know that you're conserving food. And it worked, right? There were other ways of helping, support. You could follow Meatless Mondays or Wheatless Wednesdays. There was a school garden movement. The school garden movement had actually been a progressive idea to teach urban children how to garden in the early 1900s. Well, this carried on into the war. And it wasn't just children who could raise gardens now. It's suspected that adults would raise gardens. There were plots set out in the middle of Louisville, Lexington, and other big cities, Bowling Green, to let people raise food for the war effort. There was also coal issues, fuel issues in Kentucky. There was a fuel administrator named Wiley Bryant, who was actually a Louisville businessman. His job was to try to ensure that enough coal was going up north to steel mills and so on, but also to make sure that there was enough coal staying in Kentucky. The winter of 1718 was absolutely one of the worst, maybe the worst, in Kentucky history, and there were communities suffering without coal. It was all going north. So he had rather a rough job of it, I think. And in fact, at one point at the end, he was about ready to give it up and join the army. He thought that would be a lot easier a job. Kentuckians follow things like lightless days. They had to save gas toward the end of the war, toward August. You were not supposed to drive on cars on Sunday. And if you did, your name might end up in the Georgetown Times, okay? And of course, most of these people had the excuse they were going to church, but that didn't help all the time. Women and children were expected to participate fully in this effort, okay? Initially, there was formed a committee, a sort of subcommittee in essence, of the National Committee, National Council of Defense. It was a women's committee. And they looked to Kentucky suffragette Madeline McDowell Breckinridge, who was DeShay Breckinridge's wife. She was a national leader in the women's movement. And they looked to her to help lead this Kentucky women in the war. But at one point, she wrote to a governor, the one before A.O. Stanley, saying that Kentucky women are not idiots, even though they are closely related to Kentucky men. You can't ignore them and treat them as if they were kindergarten children. And then when work is needed, expect them to do a man's work or a woman's, as you are pleased to state it. She was ill. She was incapable, really, of leading the effort. But there was a woman in Louisville, Sally Bruce, married into a well-known Kentucky family. Her husband was a significant lawyer. And she led the Kentucky division of the Women's Committee of the CND. And this was primarily an effort by progressive club women, quite frankly. They had, a broader view of war support. For example, they supported a program, a child weaning program. When the soldiers went off the camp, it was discovered that, you know, a lot of them were undernourished, in a sense, couldn't pass the minimum weight requirements and so forth. And so, you know, there was an investigation whether there was a correlation between, you know, how, you know, your weight in size at a certain age and your future health. So the women took part in a child weighing program throughout the state. Let's see, what else did they do? Well, in basically, in some counties, they really led the effort to buy war bonds and certainly the Red Cross and so forth. Children were also expected to do this. Boy Scouts were expected to sell thrift stamps. They were expected to garden. African Americans were expected to participate in this. Now, of course, there was a particular dilemma for them. You know, why go out and fight and make the world safe for democracy when you didn't have certain democratic rights here in the United States? So this is the real issue for African Americans. But Kentucky African Americans rallied to the flag. There was a fellow, a journalist up in Louisville, Roscoe Conkling Simmons, who went a tour of particularly central Kentucky. He was apparently a fantastic orator and generated support, African-American support for the war. A newspaper publisher down in Hopkinsville, African-American newspaper publisher named Phil Brown, worked carefully with Fred Sackett on the food issues in Kentucky. Blacks supported the war by buying bonds. They enrolled in the military. They, you know, conserved food. They did everything that they were asked to do. Did this help? Well, I finished that chapter on African Americans with a case of at the end of the war, I guess in December. There was an African American soldier traveling on a train down through Fulton to his home in Alabama. He got into a little scuffle, I guess, with the law authorities, and the citizens in Fulton County took him out and hanged him in his soldier's uniform. So it was clear that much more had to be done. It would take another world war and a civil rights movement for African Americans to begin to even enjoy some of the rights that come with democracy. I talked a little bit about the economy being boosted by the war. Tobacco, hemp production, coal and gas all went up. Lumber was repurposed for war needs. Hillers and Bradley no longer had to make baseball bats. They could make the cases for ammunition and guns. Alcohol production was nearly ended. I think there were only about 8 places that could produce alcohol for military purposes, that is, for use in armaments during the war. So this, of course, made the prohibitionists totally happy and was then followed by the prohibition law. Sports like baseball and horse racing did continue, but they were somewhat curtailed. The horsemen were pretty smart about this. They decided to donate large amounts of money from purses to the Red Cross, so they were able to justify continuing with horse racing. There were very few labor problems in Kentucky, particularly some in Louisville, but nothing like in other states. Religious organizations were expected to participate fully. All countries thought they had God on their side. You read Philip Jenkins' The Great and Holy War, and you get a great view of the effects of religion on the war. Some people thought there were eschatological implications of the war, that this might, after 4 years of ridiculous, hideous killing, that this might signal that close to the end of our society, of the world, basically. Especially after after the British captured Jerusalem in December 17. In the United States, most groups, even so-called pacifist religions, fell into step. The religious group that probably benefited the most from supporting the war strongly was the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church in Louisville, particularly led by a fellow named Patrick Henry Callahan, was an important Louisville businessman. And, the question for Catholics was, they're suspicious. Okay, I mean, they owe their allegiance to somebody who runs another country, the Vatican. Okay, a sentiment that existed when I was a kid, 8 years old in 1960. I mean, but Catholics got in there, both Irish and German Catholics throughout Kentucky, and they supported the war effort. Southern Baptists, despite Boyce Taylor down in Murray, they went along with this, particularly from led from the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary up in Louisville. The president, E.Y. Mullins, actually served on the board, served as the religious leader of the YMCA efforts at Camp Taylor. Christian Church, even the Disciples of Christ, who had a pacifist history, pretty much fell in the line to support the war. Even at the end of the war, basically in the last week, the war ended more suddenly than people had initially anticipated. They thought it was going to go at least into 1919. Anyway, there was an ecumenical effort, the United War Work Campaign, throughout the state, that you found Catholics, priests talking in Baptist churches and so on and so forth. It's higher education. H.H. Sherry was a good example of how higher education was evolved in the war. Frank McVeigh, the new president of UK, played a strong role. He headed up a federal group to try to put men into certain labor positions. They established some military training camps, I think a mechanics camp up at the UK and so forth. And so all the universities were involved. Most of them tried to get a student army training corps. Western got one, UK, and even Bethel College, I think, got one. Unfortunately, this was done late. It was supposed to go into effect basically with the fall semester of 1918. The Spanish flu disrupted all this. The students were actually sent home during that time. In the book, I do, again, focus mainly on what was happening in Kentucky, but I do have one chapter on our Kentuckians who went over there. I better cancel that. Okay. There were two Medal of Honor recipients from Kentucky. One was a native Kentuckian, Willie Shanlon from down in Breathitt County in the mountains. It was kind of a tragic figure. I mean, he was a war hero, but he was a sergeant. He'd been in the Army before the war, but he was basically illiterate, so he knew he'd never become an officer. After the war, he then joined Cora Stuart Wilson's illiteracy campaign. The other fellow was actually born a Hoosier, Samuel Woodfill, but had been stationed in Fort Thomas up in northern Kentucky and married a Kentucky girl. They even named I think it's an elementary school after him up in northern Kentucky. Kentuckians served all across the globe, from the Western Front to Vladivostok, which is over in eastern Russia. They served in northern Russia in the so-called Polar Bear Expedition. You know, for some of our soldiers, the war didn't end on November 11th of 1918. A bunch of them were sent to help fight the Reds up in northern Russia. In fact, one of my former bosses at UK from Paducah, John Yop, his father was part of the so-called Polar Bear Expedition, which was primarily soldiers from Michigan who went and fought in northern Russia. Kentucky lost about 2,500 men to the war. I go on, and I like that chapter because I've used a lot of soldier letters home that were published in newspapers and also found in some archives. And one of the striking things I saw was that they all thought France looked like Kentucky, which they liked, but they also wanted to get home. You also see the permeation of religion in soldiers who were at the right on the cutting edge on the Western Front. Well, of course, the war did eventually end. There was an armistice signed to end the war on the 11th hour, the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918. There were actually two armistice celebrations. Bowling Green was one of several communities in the United States that celebrated the armistice on November 7th. There was an erroneous report in a newspaper, one of the major... It was either UPI or AP. A reporter published that the armistice was to take place on November 7th. This was actually the day in which the German delegation crossed over to talk with the French. But there was, great celebration in several cities. The New York World reported this, and I think that's what set it off. But anyway, the real celebration, of course, came on November 11th. I talk a little bit in here about the effects of the Spanish flu on Kentucky, using primarily Nancy Bear's article, great article about the thing. Some stuff I found up at the Filson about how Catholic nuns went throughout the state to help. One of the things that Catholic nuns do is they teach, as I found out, and they were nurses, and so they went into several areas of eastern Kentucky, which had basically never seen Catholic nuns, and helped out during the Spanish flu. As with the Civil War, their efforts to commemorate, memorialize World War I soldiers, UK's Memorial Hall was suggested in April of 1919 to they would erect a memorial, And it was done by 1929. And we're not talking about Memorial Coliseum when they play basketball. We're talking about, you know, the church or the steeple kind of building, so which used to be part of the UK logo until the athletics department changed it, basically. I looked for the memorial to World War I here in Bowling Green. I looked online, and then I went downtown. I see a head nodding, but is it dedicated only to World War I, or is it cover the gamut?
I believe it's World War I, and it's in front of our old courthouse.
Okay.
Kind of next to.
I need to go back, because I thought that one. I thought that one covered them all, but most community, a lot of communities, created, you know, in the 1920s, memorials to World War I. There are eight of the same statue in eight cities in Kentucky, because this guy up in Indiana, Vicesny, created a cottage industry cranking these things out. There are about 120 of them in the United States, and you can actually go on eBay and find not only Civil War baseball cards or cards, but also find little, you know, statues of the spirit of the American Doughboy, and some of them are lights. I keep threatening to get one, but my wife puts a kibosh on that. The American Legion became a very important group after World War I as a result of soldiers' participation in World War I. The Gold Star Mothers was founded by a woman up in Indiana, but was very prominent here in Kentucky. There was a woman over in Paris whose son, Reuben Hutchcraft, was the youngest Kentucky state legislator, and before he was 25. And he volunteered to go in the Army and was killed on November 1st of 1918. She subsequently became the head of the Gold Star Mothers. Gold Star Mothers meaning mothers who had lost a son who were actually killed in the war, as opposed to Blue Star Mothers, which also still exist, to simply commemorate people who have kids who have served in the military. So, anyway, I know my time's running out, so I'm gonna conclude. In my studies, I discovered, I think, pretty well that Kentucky's efforts to support war were very bipartisan. Kentuckians served in the military, conserved food and fuel, increased food production dramatically, supported Liberty Bonds tremendously. They had few problems with the draft or resistance to the war. It helped improve the economy, at least temporarily. Civic action increased dramatically. The war made Kentuckians more aware that they were not only just part of a county or even a state, but part of the nation as a whole. War increased the role of the government and set the stage for future federal and state involvement in people's lives. And I actually have a few pictures, which I'll run through quickly. Here you see DeShea, Underwood, and Henry Watterson. Watterson got a Pulitzer Prize for his commentaries decrying the Germans. He was initially an Anglophobe. But then switched to becoming very much a Germanophobe, and wrote an editorial called "The Hell with the Hohenzollerns," who were the family name of the German emperor. Here we have Irvin Cobb and Alexander McClintock. If you look at the World War I memorial in Lexington in front of the courthouse, you will find an interesting name there. Alexander McClintock, the guy who joined the Canadian Army, when he came back to the United States, he eventually transferred into the American Army and was getting ready to go back abroad. He was in New Jersey. He went into New York City, checked into a hotel, and committed suicide. He is actually listed on the Fayette County Memorial, World War I Memorial, as another Kentucky victim of the Great War. Here we have H.H. Cherry, who, again, did an absolutely fantastic job for the council. The Reverend Boyce Taylor. Here we have some African-American draftees in front of the courthouse there in Lexington. And when they opened Camp Taylor in September, they had chutes and they had signs, Kentucky, Indiana, and Illinois. And here's the one from Kentucky. You can't really see the sign real well. But John Herbert was the first guy in line. John Herbert was from Louisville. He's a firefighter and spent the whole war there at Camp Taylor. as a firefighter. And as you can see in the picture below, Camp Taylor was pretty extensive. Fred Sackett, here you see, you know, food and fuel conservation. Posters were, of course, a big deal during that war. Kentucky, UK, actually had a training program for women telegraphers so they could take the place of men. The posters below show, you know, emphasis on women and children participating and supporting the war. Here, picture of Phil Brown. Here's African-American trainees at Camp Taylor in front of the Knights of Columbus building. They had programs for them. The there wasn't that much racial strife at Camp Taylor as there was in so many other camps, particularly in the South, but also in New Jersey had a big race riot. Here you see Willie Sandlin and Samuel Woodfield. You know, there's Woodfield. Woodfield was Pershing's hero. Pershing really liked Woodfield. He thought he was the consummate military man. In Armistice Day celebration, you can't really say it, but, you know, it says, damn the Kaiser. Memorial Hall. And then since I couldn't find the memorial here in Warren County, I had to turn to Barron County. Is Marvin Claypool here? Marvin. This is for you.
Thanks.
Okay? Marvin is actually works with the Cultural Center over in Glasgow, is on the Kentucky World War I Commission. And so there's the nearest memorial that I could find. So that's it. I hope I didn't go over too much. Thank you.
Oh, we have time for questions.
Questions, comments, testimonials, complaints?
Near the end, you were talking. Oh, we've got one back here. Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, he wants some. He wants a chance at the Booby Prize. One of the books.
Roughly, where was Camp Taylor in Louisville?
It's now a subdivision. Down, I guess, Taylorsville Road. It's sort of
part of it's a zoo, isn't it?
I think that is.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Where the zoo ends up.
It didn't last long. After the war, they
disappeared.
They broke it up and sold off the lumber, and it became a neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
And I think the only thing left might be the naturalization tree stump. About 20% of American soldiers were not naturalized citizens. And so they would have these naturalization ceremonies under this big oak tree, and a federal judge would come in and, you know, do whatever they do. So I think that may be, there may be one other building left there.
There's a maintenance garage in Louisville Park.
Yeah.
That is.
Yeah.
And then also the Commandant's House has just recently been put up for sale.
Okay.
But if you're interested in Camp Taylor, they have a website.
Oh, yeah.
Camp Zachary Taylor.
Yeah.
Historical Society website,
yeah.
Which is excellent.
There's a guy down there who runs this that just knows everything about Camp Taylor. It's tremendous. And it was a great boon for Louisville.
What about women? In WW1, was there women units?
Well,
military units.
The Marine Corps actually had 200 women, including Jane Russell. They're called Marinettes. And of course, they took over some jobs in offices. But no, women did not serve.
You mentioned the telegraphers. There's, I think, a new book coming out recently. That, I don't know about Kentuckians, but
okay.
There were.
Yeah. And women were in civilian jobs, you know, taking over roles for men. But no women. There were donut dollies. You know, YMCA. There were two sisters from UK. One was the head of the home ec, who went over and served with the YMCA. Mary Sweeney, her sister Sunshine Sweeney. I think somebody ought to write something about that. They were tremendous. So, yes, sir.
How many soldiers were from Kentucky?
There were about 100,000 Kentuckians who served in the military. With, you know, most, of course, in the Army, some in the Navy, some in the Marines. Yeah.
So the casualty rate was not that high compared to other wars.
No.
2,500 deaths.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
So I know this kind of more about World War I in general. Trench foot was a big deal in World War I. By the time America got into it, were we aware of trench foot and the effects of it, the gangrene and all that?
Trench foot and cooties? yeah, Americans were aware of that. Americans didn't spend as much time in trenches
know, Pershing was keen on war movement. And so Trenchfoot existed.
But it didn't affect the Americans.
The Spanish flu existed. I mean, the Spanish flu decimated units quite terribly during the war. So, yeah. Yes, sir.
When I was growing up in the 50s, there was an old man in town. He was completely silent. He would walk in the general store, maybe stand by the stove for a minute, and then go out and not say a word. And it was said that he had been gassed or I don't know if it was shell shock. Gas.
Yeah.
I just wondered if any of these histories talk about the wounded and how they
the county
ended after the war or anything like that.
The county histories, the ones I found, generally had lists of the wounded and from the counties.
Yeah.
Did they go into details? Not too much.
It was tragic to
shell shock, of course. You know,
his life was just ruined.
Yeah. Americans. You know, people say, "Well, the Americans only suffered 110,000 casualties in war." The Americans weren't in there that long. You know, it took basically a year to get American troops over there and ready. We sent over 2 million over there. It pales in comparison to what the French and British suffered. But on the other hand, if you look at American casualties in the last war, the Meuse-Argonne, I mean, they were tremendous. I mean, if that thing had continued more than, 25 days, American casualties would have been out the roof. So we were lucky in that the German final offensive, the fifth one, petered out in summer, and things ended up a lot sooner than originally anticipated. Yeah. Other questions? Comments?
What are you working on now?
I am working on a monograph for the Marine Corps History Division, a short piece on the final stages of the Meuse-Argonne campaign. Meuse-Argonne campaign kicked off at the end of September. It was the final push. It's in 33 phases, and I'm covering the phase from November 1st to November 11th. November 11th being a very controversial day, because everybody knew the armistice was coming. Everybody knew that the German Hertzberger's delegation had come over. But on the night of November 11th, the Marines were sent across the Meuse River to attack the Germans, and that became quite a controversial thing. It was a subject of it. It wasn't just Marines, it was Army men, but I'm going to be right about the Marines who went over. And there was a young fellow from Cincinnati who was killed at 10 o'clock on November 11th. Mm-hmm. You know, the question is, why? I mean, they were late. Everybody knew it was coming. Why persist? Yeah. So that's what I get to work on now.
Well, on that note, we want to especially thank Beth Reddy.